The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for May the 12th. I'm Alok Jha. Coming up on this week's show, we take a trip through the human head with scientist, philosopher and poet Raymond Tallis. He thinks the brain gets too much of the attention whenever people talk about the head, and his new book aims to put the story straight. Also in the podcast,
2019 will be the 50th anniversary of the first human landing on the moon. I think it is not unreasonable to assume that Europe becomes a partner in such a program. And if that comes true, then one of those whom we are selecting now will be the first European on the moon.
We meet some of Europe's wannabe astronauts. Plus, the head of MIT's electronics lab explains why the future health of our planet depends on low-power computer chips. We discuss whether the government was right to reclassify cannabis, and we'll also take you through the genes of the strangest mammal on Earth. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. With me today is James Randerson, the Guardian science correspondent. Are you feeling suitably angry today?
Yeah, a couple of things made me angry this week, yeah.
Good, good. You sound very calm right now, though. Keep
your
anger.
Don't worry, it's calm before
the
storm.
Yeah, no, good, good. Also here, making a long way to come back, is the Guardian's environment correspondent, David Adam. David, welcome back.
Hello, Alok. Hello, James.
Hi, David.
you left to start off your own podcast after a while, and now you're back with the band. What happened?
Yeah, well, I can't really comment on that.
Right,
for contractual reasons.
Yes, that's
right. Well, let's not say anything more about
it. I'm glad the artistic differences are over, I think, now. That's good.
We're back as a band. It's like Spinal Tap. We'll begin with some vomiting, mucus, baldness, snogging and smoking. If you've ever wanted a tour around some of the least pleasant parts of your head, The Kingdom of Infinite Space is the book for you. It's written by a friend of the pod, Raymond Tallis, who, as well as being a professor of geriatric medicine at the University of Manchester, is a philosopher and a poet. James spoke to Professor Tallis about what he calls a fantastical journey around your head, and began by asking why, for him, the brain is such a bit player.
Most people seem to think that the brain is the complete explanation of what we are. Our identity, our selfness, indeed our consciousness, is to be found in the isolated brain, and I don't think so.
Interesting. So the self that you're talking about is not just about what's going on in consciousness and within the grey matter, it sort of extends out into all these other functions of the head.
Yes, I mean, you say consciousness and within the grey matter, that presupposes that consciousness is located in the grey matter, and my own feeling is that consciousness isn't located in that sort of way. Clearly, we are embodied subjects, and being an embodied subject doesn't mean just being a brain or even just being a body. It means being a body in a material environment, but more importantly, relating to a community of minds that's been built up by millions of brains over hundreds of thousands of years.
Is that quite a controversial position? Because it seems to go against a lot of the popular science that's out there at the moment that really says, you know, it's the grey matter that matters, if you like.
It is, and it's getting more controversial as time goes on. It seems to me that the trend is increasingly to try and find bits of ourselves in bits of brains. You know, you'll find people saying people now know what love is in neural terms, or, you know, what patriotism is in neural terms, and so on. It's a bit like the phrenology of the 18th century, and it's just got more expensive equipment.
So this is a sort of a fight against reductionism.
Absolutely.
In neuroscience.
Quite. Reductionism reduces us basically to a series of material processes. Material processes that are not particularly unusual. After all, an awful lot of neural activity occurs in the absence of consciousness or selfness. No one pretends for a moment that what happens in my spinal cord is part of myself, and yet it's the same sort of activity.
There's a wonderful quote that you use in the book from Larkin: our flesh surrounds us with its own decisions. Which seems to me that also taps into this idea of things sort of happen around us. Our hair grows, our tears well from our eyes, sometimes mucus comes from our nose. It's an interesting image that you conjure up there, I think.
I think that line from Larkin is brilliant. I think it captures our peculiar situation of being identified with our bodies, but at the same time being rather surprised, disappointed, frightened spectators of our bodies. An awful lot that our daily life depends on is not under our control at all. I mean, the healing of a wound. Something can happen to my hand and I can see the wound gets on with healing itself. I have absolutely no means of controlling it. I wouldn't even know how to do it. I couldn't even get my heart to beat if it didn't do it for itself.
So do you think that we have a kind of superiority complex in a way that we want to feel that we're in control of all these things and we have to kind of slightly let go a little bit? I mean, partly as people, but also as scientists, and accept that these things aren't really under our control.
But a lot of things are. I mean, that's the surprising thing. It's extraordinary given that our flesh surrounds us with its own decisions, how many decisions we do make, the extent to which we lead our lives rather than simply being led by the evolving organic processes of our bodies. And I think that is a rather remarkable thing. And it happens because we get our heads together. We collectively, as it were, gain some kind of purchase on our individual bodies.
There's also a lovely interlude, a kind of sub-chapter on smoking. And you start that off with quoting Bob Newhart, who's this comedian talking about Sir Walter Raleigh trying to convince someone of the idea of smoking. And I remember listening to this as a kid, so it brought back great memories for me. And it's quite nice to have something like that in a book about science. I mean, clearly you're trying to do more here than just, you know, educate people about science. There's a lot of poetry in this book as well. Was that a very conscious thing, or did it just sort of happen?
Very much so. And in fact, I'm really grateful for my publishers to allow my inner Martian to sort of follow the ideas where they took me. Smoking is very interesting. I mean, the Bob Newhart sketch is hilarious, you know. I don't think you're going to be able to sell people that idea of stuffing burning leaves in your mouth, Walt, sort of thing. And of course, how wrong could he be? 1.1 billion people are smoking even as we speak. I think it was Richard Klein said, you know, cigarettes are sublime. And a sort of awful way they are. They're a beautiful marker of the unfolding of time, marvellous punctuation marks of our daily round and so on. They just happen to kill people. But it was an opportunity when thinking about smoking absolutely to digress into all sorts of poetic flights of fancy.
There's another chapter. Well, I'll read the quote first. No orgasm, symphony or wartime briefing could be so all-consuming. Now, what you're describing there is vomiting. Beyond that is quite a sort of graphic description of what happens when you vomit. And it struck me as I was reading it that I don't think I've ever read a chapter about vomiting before. That must have been quite fun to do.
I really enjoyed it. I mean, vomiting, first of all, is a good example of the flesh surrounding us, literally, with its own decisions. But it's such an awful thing that we make such marvellous jokes about it. I mean, I quote a joke I very much enjoy from Les Patterson, a.k.a. Barry Humphreys, describing Les Patterson crossing the Atlantic on a duty-free trip and vomiting copiously in the lap of a lady with a chihuahua. And as he's cleaning her up, he lifts up the chihuahua, which is still wriggling, and said, God, I don't remember eating that. And it just seems to me that captures the awfulness of vomiting.
The excellent Raymond Tallis there. His book, The Kingdom of Infinite Space, A Fantastical Journey Around Your Head, is out now. And you can hear the full interview with Professor Tallis as this week's Science Extra. Head to guardian.co.uk/science or iTunes for that. James, one question, actually, before we move on to the next thing. Last time Raymond Tallis came into the studio, he was wearing a fantastic red hat. Was he wearing a red hat when you met him this time?
Sadly not, but...
Stylish?
Rather dandy, I would say.
Excellent.
On today's Football Weekly Extra, we're on the edge of our seats like Michelle McManus flying economy as we look forward to the Premier League's final day. Will United wig out at Wigan? Will Chelsea bust their buns at Bolton? Meanwhile, who's heading for the drop? We have full previews and predictions from the Football Weekly crew. Elsewhere in the wide world of Europe department, there's yet more humiliation for Barcelona in Spain, a roundup of all the crazy transfer talk, and a special Eurovision section from our Sid Lowe. In France, there's a dangerous legal precedent, and this one's not going out with Carla Bruni, as Nancy get their lawyers on the Ligue 1 asses. There's Italy too, the FA Trophy at Wembley, and all sorts of listeners' posts in Football Weekly Extra. For details, go to guardian.co.uk/football.
I'm Alok Jha, you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, how low-power microchips could save the world. Plus...
What is it about an astronaut that makes you want to do that, though?
I never like to do anything the easy way, and becoming an astronaut is the ultimate challenge.
You can listen to Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample's attempts to ingratiate himself amongst some future astronauts. But first, here's a pick of the other science stories making headlines over the past 7 days. This is David and James with your News Jam.
News Jam.
Survival rates for babies born before 24 weeks are extremely low and getting no better in spite of medical advances. That's according to a report published last week in the British Medical Journal. The research comes as anti-abortion campaigners attempt to persuade the House of Commons to lower the legal cut-off point for most abortions from 24 weeks to 20 weeks by arguing that medical science has rendered the later limit out of date.
The first signs of a green revolution are emerging around the country as Britons treble their recycling and increase their use of public transport. But this enthusiasm is not reflected in attitudes towards other environmental concerns. With car ownership and use on the rise and air travel increasing substantially over the last 4 years, Research by the Office of National Statistics showed that public attitudes to the environment were changing, with recycling increasing by 27% across all regions between 2002 and 2006.
The government defied the advice of drug experts last week and upgraded cannabis from Class C to Class B. Tougher sanctions will replace the current system of police warnings, and officers will be able to arrest first-time offenders. Home Secretary Jackie Smith justified her decision by highlighting the strength of skunk strains of herbal cannabis now widely available. The Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, the government's own expert body on drugs, had decided by 20 votes to 3 to recommend that cannabis remain a Class C drug. Its 9-month review concluded that while more potent homegrown strains of herbal cannabis, such as skunk, now dominate the British market, the evidence of a substantial link with mental illness remains weak.
And finally, the genome of one of the strangest mammals in the world, the duck-billed platypus, has been sequenced. The research shows the animal is a bizarre mix of mammal, bird, and reptile with very complex sexuality. While humans have 2 sex chromosomes, the X and the Y, the platypus has 10, with 5 of each kind. Thought to have begun to diverge from other mammals around 170 million years ago, the platypus has been regarded as the nearest thing biologists have to a missing link between the earliest reptiles and mammals.
Thank you, David and James. Between you, you sound like a footballer. James, let's talk to you about the abortion story. This was a paper in, as we said, the British Medical Journal. Can you just take us through the headlines of what the researchers found?
Well, it's a big study over 12 years in the Trent region looking at the survival of premature babies. So this was between 1994 and 2005. And they split that time period into two. And they said, you know, has there been any improvement in the survival rates between the beginning and the end of the study? And they find categorically no. 18% of babies born prematurely at 23 weeks survive and end up going home with their parents, and none of the 150 babies born at 22 weeks survived. But there were quite big improvements in survival rates at 24 weeks and 25 weeks.
So this is quite interesting because it sort of pours cold water on those people who say that the abortion time limit should be brought down because babies at that age could also survive.
Yeah, I mean, there is a formulation of the argument for the current limit on abortion, which is at 24 weeks, saying that that is the point at which a substantial number of babies survive if they're born prematurely, whereas if they're born below that, then they don't survive. Now, that sort of opens up the question of, well, if we have improvements in the survival of premature babies, then maybe we should bring down the age of abortion, which is the argument that's been deployed by some anti-abortion campaigners or people who want to restrict that time. But the weird thing is that people on both sides sort of blame each other for using these figures in this way, if you see what I mean. I mean, it seems to me quite clear, partly from this study and also from a massive study called Epicure, which looked at the whole country, that the survival rates of premature babies are not getting better, although there are some other data which suggest they are, but for various reasons, I don't think those are really worth putting too much weight on. But the whole question of whether this is relevant to the abortion debate or not is the more important one here, I think, because just because a baby can survive at 23 weeks, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong to abort that baby under certain circumstances. And let's face it, very few abortions happen after 20 weeks anyway.
How do you think this research, which, as you said, only supports stuff that's happened before with Epicure and things like that, how do you think it's going to affect the vote that's going to happen in the House of Commons later this week on the embryology bill, which is why this is all happening now? I mean, this is why it's in the news and why the MPs are sort of arguing one way or the other.
Yeah, it's no accident that the BMJ decided to put out this study at this particular time. I mean, the people who kind of cling most strongly to the sort of scientific evidence for a 24-week limit, to be honest, is the government, because they like to say, oh, we're just following the science and the science supports this, and therefore they don't have to show that they're taking some kind of, you know, controversial moral stance, if you see what I mean. They can almost wash their hands of the decision slightly. I don't think it will make very much difference to anyone. I mean, there's been a lot of argument over whether the time limit should be moved or not, and I don't know. The abortion debate is so emotive that I think most MPs probably have a fixed position on this anyway, and they probably don't care.
The Guardian has just published today, in fact, a poll on this very subject. I mean, what were the sort of trends that came out on that?
Well, we polled MPs on their position on abortion because what's likely to happen, it won't have happened yet, but the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Bill doesn't explicitly include abortion, but there's a Tory MP who plans to bring an abortion amendment in. In fact, there'll probably be more than one amendment on abortion. But we polled MPs on the abortion question, but also on the three things that Gordon Brown has allowed a free vote on that are part of the bill. Abortion, obviously, is a free vote issue, and MPs are coming down against moving the current limit, whether that's anything to do with this evidence or not. As I say, I suspect probably they had fairly fixed positions on it anyway. And it also looks like on the other three issues, the hybrid embryos, the save your siblings, and the need for a father clause, which is being removed to allow lesbian couples to have children via IVF, on all of those issues, it seems as though the original government formulation is going to be supported, so broadly the kind of pro-science formulation.
Which is good news. Let's move on to the environment now. David, this report from the Office of National Statistics tracked Britain's recycling and sort of environmental record. What are some of the headline numbers?
I think what it does, it pulls together some of the trends that we've probably known about for a while. Most obviously that recycling is going up, has been going up for several years, albeit from quite a low base. We're still way behind some of the other European countries. Historically, we've been awful at recycling. Now we're not bad. Car use has increased and flying has increased as well, perhaps not surprisingly.
One of the comments made by the people at the Office of National Statistics was that we seem to be more environmentally aware, yet we are flying more, for example, and the carbon footprints perhaps are going up for that reason. It's a bit of a mixed message, isn't it?
I think it is. You have to be quite careful not to minimise the efforts that people are taking, because it's fantastic that recycling is going up. I just think there is a small danger in the message that you can do your bit by recycling and therefore you can carry on doing whatever you want in the rest of your lifestyle. Because you're quite right. I think if you were to work out the average carbon footprint of all of us, then it's probably going up.
James, you've got a question.
Is there anywhere in the world, any country in the world, where car use is going down and flying is going down?
I can't imagine so. I don't know.
What I'm trying to get across is perhaps we shouldn't be beating ourselves up too much in that, I agree that the idea that we can save the planet just by increasing recycling is clearly not going to work, but we're not the only ones who are driving more and flying.
No, absolutely. I just think that the danger in a story like this is that it's presented as Britain's getting greener, and it's not. We're just getting not as green, not quite as quickly, if that makes sense. If there aren't too many negatives in there.
That quite confusing thing too. There's an interesting article by George Monbiot last week, actually, about airships. Now, George Monbiot, ever the optimist, is suggesting perhaps airships are a solution to this. Now, is this at all serious, or is this just, is he showing that there's no way that flying can be made environmentally friendly?
I don't know. I think it is. I think it's serious. There are people putting money into this. I mean, I quite like airships.
In terms of the environmental footprint, I mean, is it true that airships have a smaller footprint than a plane, say?
Well, it is if they burn hydrogen, or they don't burn hydrogen, they could use it in a fuel cell. Yeah, because then there's no carbon. Well, you have to produce the hydrogen somehow, but they're more fuel efficient. I mean, a jet engine is very efficient at what it does, but it consumes a huge amount of fuel.
And so George Monbiot says, you know, if we have these hydrogen-burning airships, don't think of the Hindenburg. It's much more technically advanced now. But really, though, David, I mean, is this an actual option for passengers across the Atlantic?
I was about to say, I mean, I love airships. I think they look cool, they're graceful, they're interesting, they've got a great history, but I wouldn't want to get on one to go to New York, because it would take 3 days.
That's right. He does admit that a commercial airliner cruises at something like 900 kilometres an hour. And the maximum speed of an airship is a stately 150 kilometres an hour, which means that London to New York would take 43 hours, which isn't great. But I mean, for freight, perhaps, that's not too bad. Then again, George did actually end the article by saying that essentially we can't build enough of these things anyway because the raw materials just aren't there to produce the stuff.
I think there is a serious point in that if we are all agreed that the status quo is unacceptable, that we cannot keep burning carbon in the way that we do in cars and aircraft and power stations and all the rest of it. If there is some kind of price on carbon, then options like airships, they become more serious because essentially the economics changes and the search for raw materials increases. But the point is that is anyone going to make flying more expensive and more difficult to encourage this kind of technology? And I think maybe that was George's point, was that there are options out there, but at the moment they're seen as sort of fantastical because flying, for all its environmental sins, is fantastic. It's a great way to get around. It's relatively
still
cheap,
relatively
cheap, and it's quick.
Yeah, so someone's got to think these dangerous things. Now, before we get to my favourite story of the week, about platypuses. James, do you want to say anything about the cannabis decision? I mean, it's something we've followed a lot. Are you angry about that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the government has this advisory council on misuse of drugs, which includes people like police and scientists and neuroscientists, etc., who look at all aspects of the effects of drugs on human body and society and things. And they say to this group of silverbacks, could you go away and tell us whether it would be a good idea to move cannabis from C back to Class B, which means that the penalties for possession will be higher. But the government, when they decided to do that, appeared to have already made up their mind and were kind of hoping that their decision would be backed up by the scientists. And when the scientists came back and said no, they went, oh, well, we're going to do it anyway. You know, this is a democratically elected government, so they have the right to make that decision. But I think they were looking for a scientific fig leaf and then they didn't get one.
It was just a message to the Daily Mail, wasn't it, this? I mean,
it was a political
campaign. And Gordon Brown, when he turned up, he wanted to make some sort of difference. He thought, right, well, cannabis is something that was reclassified to Class C under Tony Blair's administration, and we're gonna change it back,
absolutely.
Despite all the evidence.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a way of throwing out a bone to the Daily Mail, saying, you know, be nice to us, because, you know, the Daily Mail is a very powerful newspaper. The thing is, though, that the trend in cannabis use is gradually decreasing, and switching from B to C seems to make no difference to that trend. So all that going from C to B will mean is that, you know, a few more cannabis users will end up getting, you know, having a criminal record.
Having said that, the police were quite clear that they're not going to do any more prosecuting. There was some police officers saying that, you know, it just doesn't mean that we're going to actually start arresting more people on the ground. David, what do you think?
I was just going to say, I think it's an important point that if the government is going to ignore science in policymaking, at least ignore the science in policies that don't make a difference to anybody, like this one. Fine, as far as I'm concerned.
Not in climate change day. All right, look, 2 minutes on the platypus. The platypus genome sequenced. I mean, it's a hard genome to sequence. You're a geneticist, or former geneticist, James. It's a hard sequence to do. But let's just run through some of these excellent facts about the platypus. Now, the fact that it's got thick fur and produces milk for its young, yet the female lays eggs and the males produce venom. The only mammals to do so, apparently. Well, according to this, anyway. What are some of your favourite facts about the platypus, James?
Well, my favourite fact is that the original specimen of a platypus in the Natural History Museum has a mark on the end of its beak where some pliers have been used on it. And that's because when it was first brought over from Australia, the zoologists there just did not believe that it was real. They thought it was a hoax, and they thought someone had stuck a duck's bill onto some kind of swimming mammal. And so they literally kind of had a good yank to just check. That's true.
David?
Well, I was actually very interested with James saying they had a very complex sexuality, and then he started banging on about chromosomes.
Yeah, I was thinking
a lot less interesting.
I was thinking.
But I'll tell you something interesting about a platypus. Guess how big they are. I've seen one in a zoo in Australia.
I've never actually seen one.
It doesn't work on radio, James.
It doesn't, does it?
James is saying,
about this big.
James is saying, what, about 3 feet? Well, 2.5 feet?
You're saying about the size of, what, a dog? A small dog?
Yeah,
no, I would say
quite
like
a large
cat.
Dog,
a cat. I would say a cat. What
they're much, much smaller than you think. I would say think of a squirrel without the tail.
Wow.
And that's about.
Are you sure you didn't see a baby platypus?
No, I'm not sure, but I don't think it was.
you based your entire knowledge of platypus
on a sample size of one.
On a sample size of one. Look, clearly, we have no idea.
I think we need someone to write nothing and tell
useful,
us how big a platypus
nothing
is.
Nothing useful about platypuses to say. But we're going to leave all that there. To have your say in any of this stuff, and including the size of platypuses, head to the science blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or post something on the Facebook wall. Now, it might have caught your attention that the number of microchips in everything from medical sensors to consumer electronics seems to increase every year. But there is, of course, a downside to the rapid march of progress. The amount of energy we're consuming is also increasing. And in a changing climate, that's bad news. At the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a team has come up with a way around the problem. Ananth Chandrakasan is the director of the Microsystems Technology Lab there, and his team has developed a low-power computer chip that's 10 times more efficient than those in use today. I asked them to describe his research.
The goal of our research is how can we reduce the power by an order of magnitude? So the goal would be, you know, we wanted to last 10 times longer on a battery. And the answer to that, how much longer, depends very much on the system. For example, if you have a cell phone, you know, we find that the display power can be a dominant part of the device. But in a sensor network, for example, where your processing dominates the overall power dissipation, the goal would be that you would want to reduce it by 10 times. And you have to keep in mind there are different modes that these processes operate. They could be actively computing and processing, and there could be extended periods of standby or inactive periods. So you have to optimize the circuitry for these different regions. For example, in the standby, it turns out that leakage power is extremely important. What leakage means is that even if the devices are not switching, they're drawing power from your energy source. And so we have to come up with techniques to reduce this power. So running, for example, at 0.3 volts can dramatically reduce the standby power.
That brings us to one of the biggest global issues that we face today, which is that a lot of environmentalists blame things like standby on electronic items for consuming and wasting huge amounts of electricity, mm-hmm. Which contributes to carbon emissions, of course, and climate change. So technologies like this, which are at the very sort of smallest end of this electronic world, right. could help. I mean, is that a fair thing to say?
The way I think about the whole energy problem is that you got to attack it from all angles, right? Electronics is, you know, overall, maybe not the biggest source, but if you can address the electronics power, that does contribute to the overall energy problem. The idea is that you want to look at ways that you can make electronics more energy efficient.
Going back to your sensors for a second, can you tell us a few examples of the kinds of sensors you might build using these sorts of very low power chips?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a number of different things. You could think about sensors in the battlefield that detect tanks, and you can look at firefighters and using certain kinds of sensors. But I think one area I really see over the next few years emerging is sensors that are in the medical domain. So medical electronics where you may, for example, have a Band-Aid type of device that monitors your EKG signal. And this device has to run from either a very tiny energy source or it may have to scavenge energy from the environment in order to operate. But in order to be able to operate using scavenged energy, the power consumption of the sensor, the processing, and the communications have to be extremely low.
What do you mean by scavenged energy?
Scavenged energy means that you can convert, for example, vibration, just when you're walking around, convert vibration usable electrical energy. Mm-hmm. So you would need some kind of a generator. Could be a micro-machined type of device that would convert vibrations into electrical energy. And that's just one form of energy. You know, you could think about transferring power in a wireless way. Just like you transfer data in a wireless way, you could also transmit power in a wireless fashion.
And what about body heat?
Body heat is another source.
That sounds remarkably sort of useful. But again, is that a proof of concept stage or has that been done?
I would say in the last decade or so, a lot of research has gone into energy scavenging. And there's been a number of proof-of-concept devices generated as a result of this. And I believe more recently there's quite a bit of commercial interest in taking these energy scavenging concepts and actually making them a reality.
So would you be able to build these sorts of chips and then use things like energy scavenging to, you know, charge up iPods or something? Or is that too big?
I think that certainly would be the goal one day. I don't think we're there yet. It depends on what your system is. I think certainly for an iPod, it may be conceivable that we can use energy scavenging to charge the battery.
Ananth Chandrakasan there, director of the MIT Microsystems Technology Lab. Officials from the European Space Agency arrived in Britain last week for its most eagerly awaited launch in decades, a recruitment drive to find new blood for its aging astronaut corps. The agency wants 4 new astronauts who can expect to fly on missions to the International Space Station and conceivably take part in NASA's mission to return to the moon around 2020. Officials expect around 50,000 applicants from Europe, and The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample went to meet some of Britain's hopefuls. First, though, he asked Gerhard Thiele, the head of the astronaut division of the European Space Agency, what key skills and hobbies a wannabe astronaut needs to have on his CV these days.
The people we are looking for, they feel the need, the urge to explore, to dig into the unknown and to learn about the unknown, and not only to be ready for surprises, but to enjoy surprises. So I would say what you could describe generally as an open-mindedness is a very key ingredient. On top of that, Imagine you are living for 6 months with the same people on board the space station and there's no interaction with others. It takes a special touch to do that. And so we're looking into the human side as well. How do you fit into a team? Are you able to lead a team when it is necessary? Are you able to stand in second row when this is necessary? So these are the kind of things.
My name is Dr. Tracy Dickens. I work at the University of Leicester. My official title is the Outreach Officer for the Physics and Astronomy Department and Head of Space School UK. I've actually wanted to be an astronaut since I was 12 years old. I actually have a diary entry from that year saying that I want to be an astronaut. Everybody who knows me knows that this is my dream and my determination, and I've never deterred from the path at all.
We've got to get to this question of Britain's stance on human spaceflight. Britain famously doesn't fund human spaceflight. We don't have any astronauts. What is it that you think an astronaut would bring to Britain?
I think having a British astronaut is going to open the space programme in general. A lot of people in Britain don't actually know about the European Space Agency and that ESA exists on their doorstep. So it's going to hopefully reveal to them that there are so many more things that you can do with space. You know, it's not just space, oh, that's it, that's, you know, the only thing I can do is to be an astronaut. You can go to mission control. You can work on robots that you're actually going to send to Mars. So there's so many different things that you can actually do within the space industry that are going to be part of the overall team that, you know, is going to get into space.
Hello, my name's Gail Isles. I'm working as a researcher for the European Space Agency at the synchrotron and the neutron source in Grenoble in France.
So what is it about an astronaut that makes you want to do that, though?
I never like to do anything the easy way, and becoming an astronaut is the ultimate challenge. It tests your physical, mental and emotional strengths, and I've got all of those in abundance.
Tell me, though, what makes you think you'll make a good astronaut?
I'm determined, highly motivated, very focused. My eyesight's great, and I did 99 parabolas and didn't feel sick once.
So let's say you're given this opportunity to design your own mission. What would you do?
Okay, it's quite simple. First of all, I'd make a base on the moon, live in it for a while and do my scientific experiments, and then build a ship from the moon and follow the path of Voyager and go off beyond the solar system. It's quite simple.
You've actually thought that through?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm dead serious, and I'm perfectly happy to go on a one-way mission.
Do you think you'll pass psychological testing with comments like that?
Who knows? If I make it as far as the psychological tests, then I'll already have far exceeded my expectations.
Europe got an enormous talent, and the challenge for us is to find it. But we know it's there. It's in the United Kingdom, it's in France, in Germany, it's in all European countries. And I can only encourage those who dream about this job and think they have the right stuff to not be shy to fill in the application form.
Gerhard Thieler there, throwing open the auditions for Europe's Got Space Talent. Quick question to you two here in the pod. You've both got PhDs and, you know, you're young, thrusting science types. Do you fancy, applying?
Do you have to get a pilot's medical as the first thing, which costs money? So
you can afford that, surely.
Well, maybe the Guardian can, I don't know.
It says here the Britons who believe they've got the right stuff, they're most likely to be scientists, engineers and test pilots, as you said, between 27 and 37, and you can apply at esa.int/astronaut selection after getting this medical certificate, and the application process runs from May the 19th to June the 16th, so good luck. And if anyone gets onto the programme, then come and let us know.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Let us know. The elephant in the room here, though, is that Britain doesn't actually fund the astronaut section of the ESA budget. So if one of us gets through, you know, there's a big kind of the end of it.
Well, Ian did allude to that in the interview, and I think a piece he wrote a little while ago, he spoke to the Science and Tech Facilities Council, which sort of funds the space stuff that we do here in Britain, and they were quite sort of non-committal about it. They said that if ESA wants to select someone from a space programme which doesn't fund astronauts, then it's up to them, and it'll be up to ESA to, you know, pay for it as well. I mean, it's such a shame if one of us got... One of us, I mean, the Brit got through. But yes, if any of our listeners does apply, then please do let us know, and let us track your progress. Time for some responses from you good listeners now. Last week, we interviewed Michael Heller, priest and cosmologist and the latest winner of the Templeton Prize. At the end of the interview, Heller said that Richard Dawkins had conceded a point to him once in a discussion, something that got us in the pod quite exercised. On our Facebook wall, Andy Mitchell wrote,
"Oh no, our God Richard Dawkins would never admit he's wrong in public debate. That soft-spoken priest we interviewed can't possibly be telling the truth. Wah, I won £820,000. Why can't those closed-minded people let me have all that money? You sounded like a bunch of schoolyard children whining about the size of the Templeton Prize. It's great PR. My concern from the 5th of May show is that you sounded like true believers in science, not rational defenders of science."
He goes on.
"Knickers in a Twist describes the pod's reaction to a well-spoken, humble scientist priest brilliantly. Why so disdainful of the Templeton Award winner and calling him a liar? No free passes from this devoted listener in New York."
Andrew Cooper also found the interview with Heller interesting, but he was more concerned with the Guardian's science coverage.
"I was rather horrified to hear Angry Randerson saying that there are fewer and fewer science journos left at the Grawniad. What's the story, guys? Surely you're not handing the whole paper over to Charlie Brooker."
I think that'd be quite a good idea. I quite like
James. We'll get to that last point in just a second. But did we really call Michael Heller a liar? Were we unnecessarily nasty to him last week? Heller seemed very nice and very interesting.
He did.
Riaz's interview with him was kind of just gentle,
respectful.
And what's this about the science coverage of The Guardian, Angry Randerson?
Well,
what's happening?
I think there's more one for you to answer. You're jumping ship.
Let's not say any more.
I think we should.
Alok
Jar is now the clean technology correspondent.
I am actually a pile
of
compost.
He's leaving us. He's moved to environment.
Stop complaining. You're about to go on maternity leave. You're the one who's abandoning ship, my friend. Before we leave you for the week, everyone, let's hear some more from Raymond Tallis. He's consistently spoken out against pseudoscience and crackpot medicines. And here James is asking him whether the tide of public opinion is now turning against claims made by alternative health practitioners.
One of the things that you've been a great campaigner for is the scientific method, good scientific data, evidence-based medicine, that kind of thing. What's your reading of the situation with regards to alternative medicines, homeopathy, that kind of thing?
I think things are improving. For example, there were 5 homeopathic hospitals that were funded on the NHS. One has been closed down, or at least no longer funded on the NHS, so it's 1 down, 4 to go. But why do we get such a state about it? People will say, fairly harmless, you know, if it makes patients feel good, what does it matter, and so on. Well, I think it's wrong for 2 reasons. One, I think it actually cons people. And secondly, it actually mocks the achievements we've made in trying to bring medicine to being science-based and evidence-based. You know, that represents a fantastic triumph for humanity, not only against nature, but against itself, against our tendency to con. So the idea we're going to regress back to medieval approaches to medicine is actually deeply ethically shocking.
Do you think there's a consciousness within the public now about the difference between science and non-science and pseudoscience, or is there a lot of confusion out there?
Well, I've been very encouraged by a couple of books that come out recently, one in particular by Simon Singh and Edzard Ernst, which have A, had a lot of publicity, and B, had a lot of favourable reviews. It's no longer seen as being closed-minded to oppose alternative medicine. It's actually standing up for rigour. Because that's one of the myths, that alternative practitioners are somehow more open-minded than conventional practitioners. But actually, when you look closely, they're extraordinarily narrow-minded. You know, acupuncturists have an acupuncture answer to every question, and they will not, you know, have a good word to say about homeopaths. Within orthodox medicine, we have a fantastic range of treatments for a wide variety of diseases. You know, you don't treat diabetes the same as you treat appendicitis.
Raymond Tallis there again. Remember, you can hear the full interview with Professor Tallis as this week's Science Extra. Head to guardian.co.uk/science or iTunes. On our website, you'll also find links to all the stories we've discussed in the show. And if there's something you're desperate to tell us, post a comment on our Facebook wall. My thanks to James Randerson and David Adam. Science Weekly was produced this week by Kate Taylor. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.